From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He became Detroit's 42nd police chief a year ago. Today, a conversation with Chief James Craig.
A lack of investment in this police department is a reason why we have had to fight so hard over this past year in turning the tide.
Out with the Smarter Balanced Assessment Test, back in with the old MEAP, a giant curveball for Michigan's teachers.
A lot of these teachers that I've talked to are just really frustrated by the fact that now they have just a couple of months to prepare for a test they still haven't seen.
And why Michigan's one of the most dangerous states in the nation when it comes to lightning.
90% of all lightning injuries and deaths happen outside of the thunderstorm.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. One year ago today, James Craig came back home to Detroit to become the city's 42nd police chief.
Response time, morale, precincts closed, soaring crime, a department that the community had lost total confidence in. These are the kind of things I was confronted with walking in the door.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, a conversation with Chief James Craig, the struggles and successes of his first year. But first, when Governor Snyder signed Michigan's school aid budget last week, that act officially tossed a big curveball at Michigan's teachers. The budget included a provision ordering the Michigan Department of Education to produce and administer a MEAP test in the next school year. Not the Smarter Balanced Assessment Test they'd been planning to use. That test is based on the Common Core standards the state's been using. Now, if all of this sounds confusing, try being a teacher in Michigan. How are you supposed to prepare lesson plans geared toward a long-in-the-tooth test that now needs to be overhauled with questions aligned to Common Core? NLive's Brian Smith's been speaking with teachers. Brian, what are the teachers saying now that the MEAP is back on?
You know, honestly, a lot of these teachers that I've talked to are just really frustrated by the fact that now they have just a couple of months to prepare for a test they still haven't seen.
And we know that the MEAP has been the assessment test used even as Common Core standards have been introduced. So I guess I have to wonder, haven't the teachers been using MEAP anyway? And how is this posing such a problem?
Well, the problem is that the MEAP for the last few years hasn't really been under active development. The Department of Education has certainly been getting the tests put together and sent out to the schools to actually be administered, but there hasn't been a lot of development in terms of making sure that the test is fully aligned with the new standards that are coming in that the schools have been implementing for the last 3 years. And so in talking to a lot of people, both teachers and policymakers, there's sort of been an agreement that the MEAP is going to have to change for next year and that it's going to be more fully aligned with the state's content standards and more specifically the Common Core. And so in the course of doing that, it means that a lot of questions are going to have to be drawn from other sources because the MEAP questions that have been used simply aren't as aligned with those standards as other tests will be.
Got it. So the test, the MEAP that they've been using, will not be administered. It's going to be some overhauled version. And it seems to be even some question about when will it be administered, because I know Smarter Balanced is supposed to be administered online in the spring. MEAP has traditionally been given in the fall. What are you hearing?
In my conversations with the Department of Education and some high-level folks over there, they have notified most school districts, and should be, I believe, all at this point, they've notified them that it will be a spring test, so it won't be the traditional fall MEAP window. It will be in the spring, and it's going to be online with a paper and pencil option, which sort of aligns with what these schools were expecting for Smarter Balance to be. They just don't really know what exactly the test is going to look like when they get it.
Well, didn't you even find out, you had in your MLive story, that actually one source of questions for this overhauled MEAP test could actually be Smarter Balanced?
That is accurate, and that's sort of a surprising twist here that I don't think a lot of people saw coming. To give a little bit of background, the U.S. Department of Education put up some money up front to help Smarter Balanced and the other group that's developing a national test, PARC, to really help them get started on building their test infrastructure, starting to develop questions, but then the states were in charge of actually doing the work. And as part of that federal funding, the U.S. government said, you have to make your questions freely available to any state that wants to use them. So the way that both groups have interpreted that, and Smarter Balanced in particular, is as long as a state is willing to pay whatever the per-user fee would be for those questions. If they're not a member of the group, then they would have access to those questions. But Michigan, as a governing state in Smarter Balanced, already has that access. And so they could actually take the Smarter Balanced questions and put them into a new MEEP exam, and it would be a Michigan-developed MEEP because they would be choosing the questions.
Maybe I'm connecting the dots too broadly, but it seems that if indeed that happens, that could make it easier for teachers who have already been teaching to Common Core. Yeah?
If that's what does end up happening, and the Department of Ed has been clear, the Michigan Department of Ed, rather, has been clear, they're still talking to various test vendors about who can have an exam ready and in place for that spring window. Obviously, by moving the testing to the spring, it gives them a little more time to get an exam actually put together. But yes, it does certainly seem like the questions that teachers are going to be, you know, trying to teach the information for throughout the year are going to be more closely Common Core aligned than the traditional MEEP has been. But they still don't really know for sure what exactly the questions are going to ask, because the Smarter Balanced test asks questions in a different way than other tests have. It's very much asking students not to repeat what they know, but to apply what they know to a problem to demonstrate not only a solution, but how they got there as well.
Interesting comment in your MLive story, Brian Smith, that all of this back and forth on the state's assessments, in your words, has left teachers feeling disrespected. Can you talk to us a little more about that?
Yes, I spoke to a couple teachers in working on this story, and I've spoken to some others just informally, and a lot of them do feel disrespected. They feel like their voices are not being heard in this conversation. They're not being included in the talks about how we're testing our kids and when we're testing our kids and what that test is going to look like. I had one teacher from Mount Pleasant who told me that she feels like a pawn in a multimillion-dollar game of assessment chess because the decisions are being made at a much higher level than the actual frontline classroom teachers.
And also noting that their job performance rating is tied with this.
Absolutely. The debate over teacher evaluations has been centered in large part on not only how we grade our assessments, but what those assessments are. And so there are teachers who are concerned that if the tests that they're going to be graded on are sort of an unknown, how do they make sure that they're doing the best job they can so that they're evaluated well?
Complicated, complicated situation. Brian Smith trying to sort it out for us. Brian is the statewide education reporter for MLive. Thanks so much, Brian.
Thank you.
Considering that doozy of a thunder and lightning storm that smacked a lot of us in the wee hours of this morning, knocking out power to something like 150,000 customers in Michigan, this story got our attention. Turns out when it comes to lightning, Michigan is one of the more dangerous states in the country. Mark Torregrossa is a meteorologist with MLive and FarmerWeather.com. Mark, how do we know that Michigan's one of the more dangerous states when it comes to lightning?
Well, when you look at the number of fatalities from lightning, we're up there. I think we're number 13 in the country, and we're not number 13 in the number of thunderstorms. The reason why is when you look at the activities that people are doing when they're killed by a lightning strike, it's all of the things that we love to do here in Michigan. It's boating, it's fishing, it's camping, and then it's playing outdoor sports. Soccer, amazingly enough, being one of the biggest, most dangerous activities that a person can be doing outside, and then also golfing.
So we really do need to respect this, not laugh about it and go, oh, the chances are slim to none. So it's probably worth reminding us again of the do's and don'ts.
Well, the main thing is it's real simple. If you hear thunder or you see lightning, you should be inside. Because lightning can travel quite a distance from a storm. And in fact, 90% of all lightning injuries and deaths happen outside of the thunderstorm. People say it wasn't even raining. When it starts raining, we don't want to get wet, and we run inside. So before and after the storm are actually very dangerous times too. And it's real simple. Like I said, if you hear thunder or see lightning, it's probably close enough to strike you. You should go inside. You should go inside a house. And if you can't get into a house, you should go inside some sort of sturdy building.
Now, that old game that I remember us playing as kids, where you'd count count between the you know the what would you mm-hmm. what would we do? Would we count between the time we'd hear the thunder and yeah. see the lightning?
You'd watch for the lightning strike, and then you'd start counting 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, and then you'd listen for the thunder. And that is true. About every 5 seconds, that lightning strike was about a mile to maybe 2 miles away. So, you know, if you see lightning and then you start counting and you count to 15, you know it's about 3 miles away. And then if you see lightning and count and you get down to 10 seconds, you know it's about 2 miles away. You shouldn't be doing that outside, though, because you're already too close to the lightning.
Boy, and I hear you say thunder or lightning. So even hearing thunder, we should get inside. We don't have to. It isn't and. It's or.
Correct, because a lot of times you can't see the lightning. Maybe it's up in the clouds. It hasn't become cloud-to-ground lightning just yet. But it means that there is a thunderstorm around, and there could be a strike. Now, I'll give you a little personal example.
Okay.
Just this weekend, we took our pontoon boat out on Duck Lake by Interlaken and with the neighbors, and they don't really believe in the lightning thing. And I said, I don't know. I don't know how long I'm going to be comfortable out here. And we had isolated storms building around us, and they were dissipating. And I had my head to the clouds the whole time. And then I saw a storm developing off to the east, moving east, and I heard thunder and lightning. I said, we're done. We got to go inside of the cabin. The dogs have to, you know, go potty anyway. So we're out of here. And we left. And that's the way that's what I was comfortable with.
And that's advice you're giving everybody listening. Well, as always, mm-hmm. good talking with you, getting weather advice from Mark Torregrossa, MLive, and FarmerWeather.com meteorologist. Thanks so much, Mark.
You're welcome.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, we wrestled with the polar vortex all winter long. Now it looks like we could be wrestling with a mosquito vortex all summer long. The wet spring already delivered a bumper crop of mosquitoes, but is there more on the way? Ned Walker is a professor of entomology, microbiology, and molecular genetics at Michigan State University. Ned, what are you expecting for the summer?
Well, we've got an interesting situation right now here in Michigan, especially in lower Michigan, with three different groups of mosquitoes out all at the same time, one of which is definitely a consequence of the heavy snowfall that we had in the spring.
And really, which one is that?
We call them the spring mosquitoes. The larvae live in water, and they live in woodland pools that were formed by melted snow and spring rains.
So those of us who thought perhaps the long, cold winter would kill them off were wrong.
That's right. Our mosquitoes are cold-hardy. They're used to the northern conditions, and the eggs of these species of mosquitoes, and there are many. We have about 60 species of mosquitoes in Michigan, by the way. The eggs are in the leaf litter and soil in areas that will be inundated by these melting snows and spring rains. And they're very cold hardy and even were buffered by the snow layer, which would keep them warm under there. So they did just fine through the cold winter.
That's charming. And you were saying there's actually three groups. So we have these spring mosquitoes who laughed in the face of the summer of the cold, cold winter. What comes next?
The second group is one species. It's a floodplain mosquito. And in springtime, when we have excessive spring rains, and we've had those this year, the eggs of that mosquito species, which are distributed at the sort of high water mark of our river floodplains, are inundated and hatch, and the larvae live in pools of water, not in the river itself, but in the floodplain pools that form near the river. And, of course, in lower Michigan, for example, southeast Michigan, we have, you know, the River Raisin, the Huron River.
The River Rouge.
All of these have extensive floodplain associated with the course of the river. And that's the kind of habitat for that second mosquito. It's one of the most common mosquitoes out right now, and it can have secondary hatches through the course of the summer, depending upon how much rainfall we get.
And the third type?
The third group of mosquitoes is a set of species associated with the intensity and frequency of summer rainfall. We call them our summer floodwater mosquitoes. Their larval habitat, the water that they grow up in, is different than the first two we talked about. It's more grassy meadows, roadside ditches, and railroad right-of-ways. places that will inundate and stay wet after, say, a half an inch of rain or more, probably for 7 to 10 days. And that's enough for the eggs of those species, which are down in the grassy litter at the bottom of these areas, will hatch, and the larvae will grow up very quickly, and adult mosquitoes emerge out of those places, usually within about 10 days of a heavy rainfall.
So from what I'm hearing, Ned, we are in for a lot of slapping at mosquitoes this summer. But on a serious side, with an eye on West Nile virus, and remembering Michigan had 36 cases and 2 deaths from West Nile last year, what should communities be doing right now?
Well, that's an interesting question, because it's important to emphasize that the mosquitoes that are out right now biting in such heavy numbers are not involved in transmission of West Nile virus at all.
Okay.
They are pest mosquitoes in the main. They are good carriers, by the way, of the parasite that causes dog heartworms. So that's something to keep in mind. People who have dogs should most certainly have them on the preventative medicine that the veterinarians provide for that, because this is a good year for dog heartworm. But the mosquitoes that are out now on the wing and that are biting so much are not West Nile carriers. The single species of mosquito that carries that virus is associated with storm drains and street catch basins, abandoned swimming pools, wastewater lagoons, the kind of, you know, more organically polluted and more urban and suburban type environments. And so that'll come later. And ironically, West Nile virus risk is highest in dry, hot years. And that is not what we're having so far at all.
Interesting. And, of course, what I'm hearing you say is homeowners and landlords, we hear this every year, and it probably deserves to be repeated, keep that standing water up, clean it out, and keep things dry.
It's true, but one of the big problems we have is abandoned swimming pools. With the economic downturn of the past several years, it costs a lot of money to maintain an in-ground pool.
Yes.
Like that. And it's also costs a lot of money to mitigate them, to get rid of a pool. So people will abandon them, and they fill with leaves and organic material and become mosquito factories. It's emerging as a real problem in our suburban areas.
Ned Walker is a professor of entomology, microbiology, and molecular genetics at Michigan State University, as we look forward to what looks like it'll be a very busy summer for mosquitoes. Thanks so much for your time, Ned.
Thank you.
Of today, the Big Ten has 14 members. The University of Maryland and Rutgers made it official, joining the Big Ten Conference this day. The Terrapins and Scarlet Knights will have their first Big Ten games with a pair of women's soccer games on August 22nd. The Big Ten's been working hard to increase its presence on the East Coast, including reaching a deal for the Big Ten Network to broadcast its games to Comcast, Time Warner Cable, and Cablevision subscribers in New York, New Jersey, and Maryland. Some may ask the question, will the Big Ten change its name to the Big 14? Not very likely. It has been exactly 1 year since James Craig came back home to Detroit to become the city's 42nd police chief. He was hired by Detroit's emergency manager, Kevin Orr. Chief Craig returned to a city facing bankruptcy with soaring crime rates, police precincts that weren't open to citizens after 4 p.m., and uniform officers demoralized by being spread too thin and forced to work 12-hour shifts. 12 months later, police response times have improved, crime is down, and officer morale is up. We're joined now by Detroit Police Chief James Craig. Welcome.
Oh, I appreciate it. And again, thanks for the opportunity.
You began your police career in Detroit's 10th precinct in 1977, and then because of layoffs, you headed to Los Angeles in 1981 to continue your career. Well, I'm wondering, as you came back to your hometown a year ago, what did you see as the most striking changes in the city and in its neighborhoods?
Very different. Certainly, I've oftentimes talked about this whole culture of violence, something that was very different than what I saw when I left 33 years ago. And then having moved on to L.A., another city that certainly has had its share of violence, but the culture of violence here was something like I had not seen. I mean, certainly violence directed at seniors was significant, children. It was just a very different culture, and certainly the blight really was demoralizing, and it was just the city was not the city I left. Certainly the police department was not the police department I left when I arrived.
Tell us about that.
Well, you know, Detroit Police Department in the 70s really was considered one of the premier law enforcement agencies in the country. When you look at community policing, Detroit was in the forefront. There were things that I learned in my short time here that I was able to import to Los Angeles very successfully. And so, you know, Detroit was viewed as that progressive agency. The fact that Detroit was already ahead of the curve in terms of hiring female officers. You didn't see that in a lot of other major city police departments, not to the degree that you see in Detroit. And so I learned a lot, respected the department. And again, I came back and some of the things that you pointed out, response time, morale, precincts closed, soaring crime, a department that the community had lost total confidence in. These are the kind of things I was confronted with walking in the door. And so I had a good life in Cincinnati as police chief and as police chief in Portland, Maine. But I was excited about returning home because I really believe that we could make that turn, and we have. I'm excited about what we're seeing today.
And tell us that. So a year later, what do the numbers tell you and what do they tell us? Well, why don't we start with crime rate? What was your crime reduction goal for this year and where are you today?
Well, overall crime, which is called Part One crime, we're talking about property and violent crime. We set a goal for 2014 of 10% overall reduction. Year to date, we are sitting roughly at 20%. So we're 10% better than what we hoped for. And now we're in the part of the year, the second quarter, that's usually the toughest. But other specific statistics like homicide, we're down 13%. We're certainly in robbery, which is the steepest reduction, a 39% reduction in robbery. And then the subcategory of robbery, carjackings, we're down 29%. I mean, that's phenomenal. Non-fatal shootings, those shootings that don't result in homicide, mm-hmm. we're down 14%. And so when you look at that, and we had some of the lowest months in terms of homicides this year that was statistically recorded compared to when we started in 2001. For example, we had the lowest month was March that had 10 homicides. So when I look at our numbers, the fact that when I got here in July when, crime was kind of peaking, I set a very soft goal of 5% reduction because I knew coming in and we had already lost 6 months of the year. But we ended up ending the year with an overall Part One crime reduction of 10%. So the morale started to go up because, you know, the officers were forced into these 12-hour shifts. 10% of their pay was taken. And so those changes were made very quickly as it relates to work schedules. Certainly the pay is still an issue, and I'm certainly sensitive to that, given that Detroit police officers, some of the best in the country, also work in some of the most challenging environment in the country. There's no other city like Detroit.
What do you credit when you take a look at this improvement? And granted, I'm quite sure it's not where you want it to be, but you can point to improvements. What do you think was behind that, Chief?
Well, a couple of things. You know, first of all, you know, I've said publicly and believe that cops count. When I make the statement that cops count, I'm talking about the line officer, you know, the person that, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning when you call the police, they show up. They are the face of this police department. And I felt that they didn't have leadership. They weren't supported. In fact, when I first arrived here, you know, as I do now, I continue to have conversations with line officers. And the one thing that I heard, the chief complaint or concern is they wanted to be cops again. Of course, they want their money. They wanted the 10% back. But what I kept hearing, they wanted to be cops. And so when you look at what we're doing today, you know, we're embracing police officers. We want them to do police work. They're doing that. We've had 7 large-scale operations, you know, one a month. They've had an effect on driving down crime. They certainly have had effect on those who want to commit crimes that, you know, maybe I ought to think twice. I mean, when you look at the fireworks this past week, I've talked to a few veterans who, one in particular, Sergeant Munson, who works our mounted unit. He said, "Chief, I've worked 35 fireworks." He said, "But this one was the best managed, incident-free," and that's what I continue to hear, is that this fireworks, a family affair, that people should come out and enjoy without fear, being feared of being attacked or other crimes being committed. This was an event-free family event, and that's the story that needs to be told.
What about response time? Tell what was it? We were hearing figures of 58 minutes when you came in.
59, 58. And here's the other thing that wasn't widely reported.
Uh-huh.
Because when I came in the door a year ago, it was not uncommon that 40 to 60 calls in one district being held, calls being held between shifts. So the translation of that is many of these calls went unanswered. Calls were just not being answered. And then Detroiters, who I had conversations with, constantly said, you know, why call the police? They're not going to come. And so here we are today, a year later. We set a goal of a 5-minute response time to emergency call for service, what we call priority one calls.
Mm-hmm.
And while we haven't achieved 5 minutes, we have achieved 10 minutes. So right now we're sitting on a 10-minute average to priority one calls. And that's great news. It's great news because when you look at the national average of police departments handling emergency calls for service is roughly 11 minutes. So we've exceeded the national average, but we're still pushing, and we're doing it with fewer officers than we had a year ago.
And I got to imagine that is a priority to get the ranks beefed up again.
It's a priority. We have classes in academy. We're still restructuring the department. We're redoing our narcotics unit. We have 70 officers in that unit. We're leaning that unit out, creating a major violator section that will focus on major violator narcotic dealers. Street enforcement drug dealing will be handled by the precincts. The idea is to put additional officers back into the what I'm calling neighborhood police stations, the neighborhood precincts.
And what are you hearing from people, from the residents, as far as what the community perception is of the DPD? Is it evolving?
Wow. Let me just say, I just left a coffee shop. This is just an example of what my day is like when I'm out in the community. The folks in the coffee shop are walking up to me. "Thank you, Chief. We see a difference. We feel safer." And this is a constant conversation I'm having with people who live, work, play in Detroit, but not just the residents of Detroit. I'm hearing from our neighbors over in Windsor, Canada. I'm hearing from our neighbors in adjacent suburbs that are saying, "We appreciate what we see going on in the city of Detroit." Because everyone agrees that Detroit must work. Detroit must be safe. Because in order for us to realize economic vitality, the city must be safe. This is not something that I read about. This is something I saw in the city of Cincinnati. Cincinnati became a safe city, but it also began to revitalize, especially in the Civic Center area.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, talking with Detroit Police Chief James Craig. It's been exactly 1 year since Craig was hired by Emergency Manager Kevin Orr. Let's talk about perceptions, whether it's nationally or internationally. When the subject of Detroit comes up, you can bet so does the issue of crime and violence. And I'm wondering, in your mind, can Detroit ever truly shake that stigma of being a violent and a dangerous city, no matter what you and your officers do?
I believe so. In fact, we're doing it now. You know, the one thing that we do, I think we do very well, is we work with our partners in the media, and I do view the media as our partner. We need to drive the message. We need to tell the story. We need to talk about our crime reduction efforts. We need to talk about communities' perception. Those things are important. And as we continue to push that out, people will hear the story. And, you know, when people come up to me and say, I love the job you're doing, I love what I see in the DPD, well, the only way they can see it is because they see it on the news. And we're talking about cases. One statistic that we didn't bring up is, you know, when I got here, it was like an 11% clearance rate to homicide.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're sitting roughly high 80s, 90% clearance to homicide. The cases are being closed much sooner. And so that certainly goes a long way in building that sense of we respect, we appreciate what the Detroit Police Department's doing, and we appreciate it so much is that when a crime is committed, contrary to what's put out in the media in the past, that people in Detroit don't talk to the police. They don't share information about crimes. They are doing it. And they're only doing it because the confidence of this police department is returning. And that's so important.
You refer to the media as your partners in the media, but I am wondering, you know, you've been in the spotlight now for a year in the Detroit media and Michigan's media. I'm wondering what is, as you watch the way Detroit has covered, particularly crime, is there something you would change in the way it's covered? Does it impact the job you and your officers are trying to do for better or for worse? Can you talk a little more about that?
Well, the Detroit media is very different, certainly. And this is no secret to anyone in Detroit. Very different than in other markets. I've had a good opportunity to work in now three different markets. And so there's this whole business of sensationalism, you know, ratings, and it's the violence that really gets the attention. And it shouldn't be just about the violence. You know, we had a neighborhood police officer summit this weekend where members from the community, our new initiative, the neighborhood police officers together, we had workshops, we talked about partnering, we talked about the importance of partnering in solving crimes, addressing quality of life issues. One station came out and covered it.
That was it.
One station. But the other thing, when there's something bad, like one of the local stations ran a story about me disbanding the narcotics section. Well, that was not true. Instead of trying to find out and talking to this police chief or someone on the executive team is what we were doing, they ran the story that the narcotics unit was being shut down. So what message does that send to the criminals? What message does it send to the good Detroiters who expect us to enforce the law? It's not a good one. And so they finally corrected it. But by that time, it was a very short story.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of thing that I find frustrating. But I also understand that before I arrived here, the police department didn't even talk to the media.
That's true.
So they had to get their information from other places. And so part of that culture is not what it once was. I mean, I had a great meeting with some of the news directors about 2 weeks ago. And we do it because, again, I want to make sure that relationship is one that's positive, that they can feel like we can have a conversation, because it's twofold for me. I mean, certainly they need to get the information out, but I want to get it out as well. And part of getting that information out allows us to reassure the community that we're out doing the work, that the city is not as unsafe as some may portray it. It doesn't mean that we've solved all the ills of the city. Of course, that's a work in progress. But we need to tell, we need to showcase the great stories.
Chief, you made national headlines earlier this year when you spoke out in favor of law-abiding citizens having guns and supporting Michigan's open carry law. And you were on the cover of the NRA's magazine. Can you talk a little bit about why you believe that gun ownership can be a good thing? Because it's kind of unusual for a big city police chief to be so open like this.
Yeah, very rare. In fact, there are reports that have said I'm probably one of the few. And I always started out, you have to understand the context of the comment. You have to understand the city of Detroit. We'll go back a year.
Mm-hmm.
When the police weren't always responding to emergency calls for service. Michigan became a shall issue state in 2006. So Detroiters were feeling as if, who can I count on? I have to protect myself. I have to protect my family. They took advantage of the opportunity to obtain concealed carry permits. They did that. And when confronted with a violent situation, an imminent threat to their life or the life of someone else, they responded. Mm-hmm. And what I said and what I will continue to say is that everyone has a right, an absolute right, to protect themselves from an imminent threat to their life. Whether it's their life or the life of someone else, they have an absolute right to protect themselves from great bodily injury or a sexual assault. This is not a law that James Craig wrote. But my point is, I believe in that. I support that. And I'm not suggesting, and I certainly don't support vigilanteism. You know, I've made some very strong comments of what my view of vigilanteism is and my response to it. And I also said that certainly not everyone should be a concealed permit carry holder. Certainly we look at folks that are, one, law-abiding, someone who's responsible, who's trained. And certainly, I mean, we have to consider the issue of someone who is suffering from mental illness. Right. I mean, we look across America and we look at the number of mass shooting incidents involving individuals suffering from mental illness. The big question, and my colleagues in other parts of the country, we don't have a good answer for it, but how do we keep guns out of the hands of the mentally ill? That's one. The second piece is let's change our conversation from law-abiding citizens legally possessing a firearm to the criminals who illegally possess firearms. That's the conversation as I see it, because those are the individuals. If you want to put gun control and say no one can carry a gun, I guarantee you that the criminals will continue to get guns. They're getting guns. In fact, in places like New York and Los Angeles, and while crime is down in both of those specific places, the criminals are still in possession of guns, and crimes are still being committed. And so I also talked exclusively about research that was conducted, not my research, but it's a known fact that violent felons, through some research that was DOJ funded, the researchers went out and interviewed a number of felons, ex-felons, or folks incarcerated, and they said they fear the armed citizen more than they fear a police officer. And I also said that in many ways, when you talk about a law-abiding citizen who's armed, it can also act as a deterrent to violent crime. I'm not saying it's the only factor, but a factor.
Chief Craig, we invited Michigan Radio listeners to submit questions they'd like for me to ask you. So I'm going to give you a few of these. They were interesting and very thoughtful. Deborah Hurren had wondered, what are your thoughts on the city's pension situation? Of course, you did refer to the 10% pay cut that officers had to take, but especially looking ahead to what may happen when people retire. We know cuts to pensions and retiree benefits are inevitable with the bankruptcy. And we wondered, not only how are your current officers reacting to that, but how much is all of this a deterrent to you attracting good candidates to the DPD?
It's a challenge. I'm one who always looks at the glass as half full, not half empty. Is it a challenge? Yes. Is it a challenge in terms of retention of good police officers? I mean, I just lost over the last several weeks several police officers to suburban departments. Who pay more, a better benefits package. And so, yes, that's a challenge. But, you know, I'm concerned. But as I've oftentimes said, you know, when I look at the work that Kevin Orr is doing, and certainly he's done a phenomenal a job in restructuring. It hasn't been an easy one. I can tell you, someone who has worked very close with, he cares about public safety in the city of Detroit. But I also remind folks that Kevin Orr didn't bring this financial crisis to the city of Detroit. I think many can weigh in and say how it got here, but there has certainly been an underinvestment in this police department. And so it's good news that there's been an investment as of late. You know, we got 100 new police vehicles that we have deployed in the neighborhoods throughout the city. But we also have police vehicles that are dilapidated I call it the police officer's office. Certainly when you look at that and the fact that they lost pay, where's the investment in our police officers? What did the, and I'm going to go back a couple of administrations.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly I applaud the great work that Mayor Duggan is doing. And certainly he's an out-the-box thinker, a risk taker. And we talk often about initiatives that we can get to really turn the city around. But when you look at prior administrations, and I'll go back before Bing, you know, people that were more concerned about greed, arrogance, you know, power. And what did it get us? It certainly wasn't an investment in this police agency. I'll tell you that. And the police officers feel that. And then you had a situation in this police department where there was an absence, a total absence of leadership. And I know that infuriates some of my predecessors
mm-hmm.
when I say that, but I can't make it up. I mean, I've had conversations with the police officers. I've seen the absence of accountability. And now that those things are in place, we are seeing the change today. A lack of investment in this police department is the reason why we have had to fight so hard over this past year in turning the tide.
Another question from listener Patty Farmer. She was wondering, have you noticed an increase in crime in downtown Detroit since Belle Isle became a state park?
I have not. Again, I remind folks that while there's been a, I don't want to say zero tolerance, but certainly enforcement of law violations, in response to the state taking over Belle Isle, I launched a parks unit that would address the other parks like Chandler, Rouge. And certainly there might be a mindset of some who feel like they can't violate the law in Belle Isle. They may want to go to another park. We're very attentive to that. We're taking a like posture as it relates to the other parks. These parks are designed for families where people can enjoy. This should not be a haven for criminal activity.
Wendy Wilbur, listener Wendy Wilbur, wondered, what part of your job causes you the biggest heartbreak?
Wow. Well, one of it, I have to go back to the officers. Certainly, I would tell you one of the things that, you know, I've had the misfortune in the year that I've been here, I've attended 6 to 7 police funerals. Some of them were duty-related deaths. That's always a difficult time for a police chief and a difficult time for the organization that you bury one of your own. So that's a challenge. And then the fact that many of our employees, something I've seen here that I haven't seen in other departments, is some of our police officers that are suffering from PTSD. I've been in other agencies where officers that are deployed in the military for a certain time and then they return. And when they return, they're suffering from PTSD. So there's a reintegration effort that's made, some treatment that's provided. But the uniqueness of here in Detroit, our officers are suffering from PTSD because of what they're dealing with in the city. You know, many of our officers have lost partners to violence, family members to violence. Certainly they see their fair share of violence. And so those things have an effect on our officers.
And finally, Chief, looking ahead, you were brought in by Emergency Manager Kevin Orr. You report to him. What do you hope will happen when Kevin Orr's time here is up?
Well, I'm optimistic. Certainly the mayor and I have a great relationship. We're talking about different initiatives. You know, as I've oftentimes said, you know, if the community is dissatisfied with the work that we're doing today and I'm not delivering, then I shouldn't be here. And so I'm optimistic because the people, the rank and file, the elected, all seem to be confident and satisfied with the work that's being done today. And so I'm hopeful to have a substantial tenure as police chief. You know, I'll tell you, when you look at being the 42nd police chief in a 150-year-old department, it just tells you that there's been a lack of stability at the top. And that contributed a lot. Now, I didn't talk a lot about that, but you can't have police chiefs come in and out of a police department. It just doesn't work real well. In comparison to Cincinnati, a 210-year-old police department, I was only the 13th police chief. When you look at it from through that lens, it just makes sense that stability is important. And certainly that doesn't mean that a police chief in a major city should stay for life. That's not realistic. I mean, there needs to be change. And we've seen the necessity across the nation where, you know, 3 to 5 years is kind of the average shelf life of a major city police chief. But Detroit's in need of stability. And I think the cops will tell you that.
Detroit Police Chief James Craig marking 1 year at the helm of the Detroit Police Department. Chief, thank you so much for being with us today on Stateside.
And thank you. Appreciate it.
And we would like to hear from you. Do you live in Detroit? What is your perception of crime in the city? And if you're not in the city, do you keep your eye on the news from Detroit? Let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook or on Twitter. We're at Stateside Radio. Much of our sports attention today is focused on the big U.S. versus Belgium game in the World Cup being played in Brazil. But there is a national sports title at stake beginning today in Grand Rapids. The U.S. Open Table Tennis Championship begins today. Players from all over the world will compete on 100 tables over the next 5 days. The West Michigan Sports Commission figures this event will pump $750,000 into the economy with 1,500 hotel room nights and 1,000 spectators. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer was Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Taylor Mattia, Omar Saadeh, Kayla Steinberg, Katie Suha, and Brianna Tinsley. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.